Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the show. I have an incredible guest for you today. One of my favorite voices on the planet. He's got many hit songs, but more importantly, he's an amazing human. I got tons of human questions I want to ask him. Please make a lot of noise for Allo Black.
Where are all these people?
I hide them in the walls. Yeah.
Go.
How you doing, Allo?
I'm good. Thanks for having me.
Yes, man. Good morning.
Good morning to you.
I like a 9 a.m. podcast.
I don't mind. I like to get started early.
It's good. You're a family man.
Yeah. Drop kids off at school, and then I get a good 6-7 hours to do whatever I want.
There it is. Yeah. All right. So I look up to you a lot as a man, and I really love, it seems like you have this incredible balance. I see you, you know, playing at these, at charity events. Mm. I see you being a philanthropist. I know you're an entrepreneur. You've had this huge career in music. So what advice could you give that you follow to being the best version of yourself?
Oh my goodness. Well, I really, really strongly believe the best version of myself exists only because of the people around me. And my wife is the most important person in that equation.
Amazing.
She absolutely keeps me grounded and, you know, lets me know that I may be a superstar on stage, but at home I'm just dad.
Yeah.
And husband.
Did you know that when you met her?
Oh wow. She was more of a star than I was when I met her. Mm. You know, she was the voice and face of hip hop in Australia. She had a national TV show, national radio show, and I was just this kind of up and coming, very, very obscure hip hop artist, and she happened to like my music enough to play it on her show. So
really?
Yeah, she was way more famous than I was.
And that's how you met?
That's how we met.
And then so you started dating?
Yeah.
And when that happened, were you like, oh, this is my person?
I think I knew it, you know, really, really soon. We met and I asked her to join me for like this finale party of a conference that I was at when I was in Australia.
Yeah.
But she was busy. She was working. She was interviewing other people for different festivals and things. And she said, well, when I finish my work, I'll see if I can make it. And as I was walking out of the pub, because that's where we were doing our finale party, I was about to go to my hotel. I wasn't going to stick around any longer. I'm literally walking out to get the first taxi that I find. And the first taxi that comes up, she steps out of it. And like
wow.
The movies, slow motion, yeah. Everything, she's walking up the pathway. And I'm like, wow, this is meant to be. We walk in. I was like, can I get you a drink? She says, I don't drink. And I was like, neither do I.
Perfect.
So we both shared orange juice.
I love that. I love that.
And then we got to talking about hip hop and everything that she loved, I loved.
Yeah.
She could finish lyrics to Tribe Called Quest and Nas verses. And I was sold.
Incredible. So you fall in love. Mm-hmm. You're together. She's the hot shit. You're the up and coming artist. You're on Stone's Throw. You're making cool albums.
Yeah.
And then
too cool.
Too cool. It's important. It's important. I Need a Dollar comes out.
Yeah.
Wake Me Up comes out with Avicii, becomes this huge, these are both huge songs. You're playing huge festivals all of a sudden, all this right. stuff. Like, how did that impact your relationship?
Wow. She went on the road with me for the first 3 years when yeah. the beginning of this happened. She would be on the tours performing alongside and yeah. sharing entire moments, all these moments before we had kids. And it helped us bond even more. Mm. We had the opportunity to just travel the world and see the most beautiful places without the stress of like figuring out how to pay for it, right? We're on tour. It's the tour is paying for
yeah,
it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You couldn't write a better story about all of this. And when I got tapped to open for Bruno Mars on a US tour,
yeah,
we had just had our first child and we were
wow.
going from city to city. And I decided that, you know, this is a perfect way to share the experience with our family. Like, to be on the road as a touring family. I thought that was really great. And then we had a show in somewhere in Pennsylvania, close enough to where my wife's uncle lives. So we visited the uncle, and I left my wife and my 11-month-old daughter at the uncle's house. And I go to do the gig, and I'm walking toward the stage to start performing, and I get a text, and my daughter had just taken her first steps. And I was like, I'm done. I'm not on the road anymore. This is it. Like, the whole reason the family's on the road with me is I don't miss these moments. And so after that Bruno tour, I just decided I'm not going to tour anymore. I'll take, you know, special gigs. You know, if Obama asks me to come to the White House to perform, I'll go, you know. I'll take the private gigs and stuff in the festivals every once in a while, like in the summer in Europe. But like regular touring, nah, I'll stay home and just be with the family. So yeah, it was a major and important aspect of how I engage the whole business in my life.
And how did you deal with, the pressure of, because at this point now you have success. You're like, dude, mm-hmm. You got Bruno Mars, you got hits. Like, you need to be on the road. You got to support this. So how do you deal with a label, a manager, a team that's trying to, you know, make you work? Because obviously touring is, you know, lucrative. And once you get to that point, how do you handle that?
I think it would have been different if I had had my first hit, let's say in my teens or in my 20s. But I had my first hit when I was 31. I was already, you know, already had an identity, an ideology. I considered myself a man. I knew who I was and what I wanted out of life and what I needed out of life.
Yeah.
Luckily, the songs made enough money for me to be able to just kind of look at the trajectory and say, I'm good for now.
Yeah.
And I decided that I would sort of take the reins of my business. So I wasn't obligated to a lot of the infrastructure that requires me to be on the road.
Yeah.
Or to continuously work, just so I could, you know, have more autonomy. And that really worked out. It's a very sweet spot in the business where I'm, you know, capable of living the lifestyle I want to live without the headache of sort of the super fame, superstar stardom, you know?
Yeah. I heard you mention in a prior interview about like running away from fame.
I did for a long time, purposefully.
Yeah.
With my wife, we do a lot of activism and philanthropy, and thinking about how to balance visibility and fame with influence.
Yeah.
You know, the more fame, the more influence. And so what's the trade? How much of the philanthropy can we do and activism can we do? And how influential is our voice without the fame?
Mm.
I'm getting to a point where I feel like, okay, maybe now that the kids are a bit older, maybe it's time to jump back in and really turn up the fame machine for the purpose of what I really want to accomplish, which is, you know, influencing positive social transformation.
Yes. Which is your entrepreneurial journey now?
It is actually, yeah. That's, you know, I wasn't expecting to start a business outside of music. I always thought, oh, I'll just invest in other people's companies. But I did that a couple of times and I didn't work out. I realized you don't really invest in a great idea. You invest in the people running that great idea. And if they're not experienced operators, then, you know, it may go nowhere.
Yeah.
But yeah, I started a company that I didn't expect to start. I was really doing philanthropy.
Yeah.
And learned quickly that this particular industry it's not an industry that you can develop a company or develop anything strictly based on philanthropy. It requires all of the stakeholders, almost all of them require enterprise.
Yeah. And what is this?
Oh man, I started a biotechnology company.
Of course you did. Aloe Black starts biotechnology company. It's amazing.
Totally not what I was expecting to do, but I'm a nerd for knowing the facts about as much as I can. And what is a fact? You know, I basically say that you have to triangulate the truth. You know, the truth sits somewhere inside of a triangle between three different opinion holders. And the way that I do that best is by reading, you know, academic papers. Because at that point, you're triangulating between the scientist who came up with the idea, the journal that decided to print the idea, and the review panel that said this was worthy of publishing. And that review panel is a, you know, a panel of peers, of other PhDs. So I'm assuming that whatever's inside this paper is close enough to the truth that we can get.
Yeah.
And so, you know, come the pandemic, I started reading a lot of papers around how COVID and SARS-CoV-2 works as a pathogen, and how we're infected. What are the possibilities of transforming our relationship to this pathogen? And of course, I was vaccinated and boosted, but what I really wanted was a prophylactic. Mm. I wanted something that could block and prevent infection rather than just boost my response to the infection. Yeah. And I ended up finding the scientists that were working on that after reading a series of papers. And I reached out to them and thought, you know, what is it going to take for your technology to be available to the world? And they told me, well, we have to do a battery of tests. And I said, okay, I'll basically sponsor those tests. We need what you have. By doing that, we found some success in the test that we did. And then they were like, okay, now we need to do some more tests. And I was like, okay, that means I might need to get some investment.
Yeah.
So I started a company, licensed the IP from the university, and started talking to investors. And, you know, by that time, the pandemic numbers of mortality had dropped. So it wasn't so much of a dire need for new solutions.
Yep.
And a lot of the investors were saying, well, this isn't so much of our interest anymore, but do you have anything else? And so my principal investigators, the scientists, said, well, we have 10 patents across multiple indications, different diseases. But we have this one that we have been testing on, and it almost looks like we have a solution to regulate the immune response that leads to mortal outcomes for sepsis. And I thought, that's huge.
Wow.
That's really huge. Sepsis is one of those indications that you get alignment from patient, provider, and payer. And that's hard because usually there's a battle between the insurance companies and the hospitals, and there's a battle between the patient and the hospital. But this is where everybody's aligned everywhere around the world. And it looks like we have a really promising candidate, and we have some validation from government entity called NIAID, who's interested in helping us with our non-clinical GLP toxicology studies to validate this candidate for further human study potentially.
Are you CEOing this project?
Right now I'm CEOing, and I'm talking to like different people who can help me find an experienced operator in biotech, because as much as I want to learn, I also want to move quickly, and we can move much faster if I have the help of somebody who's done this before.
Yeah, because this is, I mean, having regulations and everything on top of just running a startup is hard, let alone a biotech company where you're going to be like giving it to hopefully millions of people.
yeah, absolutely. That's, I mean, I've been able to bootstrap and learn a lot, but it's, you know, and it's not impossible to run a virtual company, but it's better to have a really solid team.
Yeah, absolutely. So how are you balancing CEOing this biotech company and still having your artist career?
Wow. Well, last night I was up late putting together a proposal for government funding. And in the daytime I was having meetings, Zoom meetings that were related to the company. And then, you know, in between when I drive to go pick up the kids, I'm listening to tracks that I need to write songs to. And when I close the laptop and I get in bed, and after I talk to my wife, she falls asleep, I'm writing lyrics on the phone.
Wow.
So it's burning the candle at both ends, sort of deal. Probably 80% biotech, 20% music.
Yeah.
But
that'll flip.
It'll flip when I have the right team.
Yeah. I love that about you, man, because it really just shows like you are so on your own unique journey. It's amazing. And you're really doing it. You're doing it your way.
Man, I feel like the luckiest guy in the world. Just positive things keep happening to me. So I have to continue to pay it forward. And I feel like with biotech, I can really pay it forward in a major way, especially because I found such an important technology. Well, I should just mention it because education is key.
Yes.
Peptoids, these are a novel class of molecules that are peptidomimetics. They mime peptides. They're mm-hmm. similar, but they have amazing qualities that make them much more promising candidates for drug development. And, you know, it's a narrow field. There are very few experts. I happened to find the ones that were working on something really, really amazing. There are others that are working on amazing things too, but I just, you know, I feel like if I don't push this, it'll be another pandemic will come and go and we could have had the solution.
Wow. Thank you. Hello, Black. This is amazing. We need people like you that are chasing ideas because these are really hard things. And I feel like this is a positive way for you to use your
fame.
We
do need more people like this. So all of my peers in music, all of my peers in entertainment who have excessive discretionary cash, please hit me up.
Yeah.
Because there's so much we can do. I've been meeting with so many people with rare indications, chronic indications, things that are like, you know, massive diseases that we can solve if we can engage in a disruptive way.
Yes.
And I'm not trying to follow the status quo for drug development. I'm pushing, hopefully pushing the envelope. Come join me. If you need to donate some money or offset some of your cash, hit me up.
If only there was a song about needing dollars.
Yeah.
Who could write that song? You're like, free license.
Yes, here we absolutely. Got the
campaign theme song. You have to have used it before. Have you used your own song for a pitch deck or for...
No, I haven't. But I use it when I perform for charities all the time.
Yes.
Yeah. It's definitely the song that comes right before the ask. And the auction.
It's like the ask and it's just a photo of you. You already know what it is. Yeah. That's amazing, man. So yeah, I feel like you've created a lot of structure in your life that works. So the balance between being a dad, mm-hmm. being a husband, being an artist, being an entrepreneur, that's a lot. And I heard that when you do your songwriting sessions with others, you limit it to like 4 hours.
Yeah.
Is that true?
Yeah.
So when did you start sculpting it this way and realizing that it works for you?
So, okay. Before I started speed dating, which basically my publisher would connect me with other great songwriters so that we could write songs.
Yeah.
Part of it is out of necessity. I drop my kids off at 8 a.m. I've got to pick them up by 3 p.m. It's going to take me an hour to get from their school, potentially in LA traffic, to the session. So I start at 9 or 10, depending if I want to get breakfast. Mm-hmm. And it's going to take me an hour to get from the session to pick them up at 3. So I have basically from 10 to 2.
Yeah.
So that's kind of the practical reason why it's a 4-hour session. And also, when we were pregnant with our first, you know, Maya was gracious enough to let me go do sessions while she was in bed, you know, getting ready to give birth.
Wow.
We were very close. And I went to do the wake me up session and it was a 4-hour session.
Oh,
I
my thought, God.
If we can do wake me up in 4 hours, I should be able to do anything else in 4 hours. Okay. So let's make it work.
How did the wake me up session come about?
I Need a Dollar had been successful for about 3 or 4 years all around the world. And Avicii had this massive success with, I Got a Good Feeling. Mm-hmm. And he was looking for a soul artist to do a song with. When we first spoke, he was looking for something like Marvin Gaye.
Yeah.
And we were connected through Interscope, through our label and the A&Rs there. Neil Jacobson.
Shout out to Neil.
Yes. Yeah. Shout out to Neil. He really made it happen, along with Neil talking to my A&R at the time, John Eamon. Both salt of the earth, amazing human beings, great guys. And I ended up meeting Avicii at my very favorite recording studio, Westlake Studio.
Beautiful.
he brought in a song written by Mac Davis, a classic old song, school songwriter. I sang that one, and then we started trying to write another song. We didn't finish that song for that session, but then when we were scheduled to finish it, we were double booked, or at least Avicii had double booked. I think he had a session with Mike Einziger from Incubus at Mike's place. And Mike said, well, you know, just bring Aloe over and we can all work on something together. So, you know, I figured, you know, it was 8 p.m. Okay, so again, I also schedule my sessions after the kids go to bed.
I was going to say.
So, but this is before we had kids in bed.
Okay, okay,
good. But it was scheduled for 8 p.m.
Oh, yes, yes.
And I figured, you know, I want to be back as soon as I can be back in case my wife is ready.
Goes into labor.
I went at 8 and I was home by midnight. And in that session, I brought the lyrics that I thought were the strongest lyrics that I had. I'm always writing. So I come from a hip hop background, and as hip hop artists, we're always writing. We don't need beats to write to.
Yeah.
Or at least my generation. We would just write lyrics. We're always writing. So I had these ideas, and when I walked into the studio, Tim and Mike had already been working on this chord progression on the guitar, and they played it for me, and I was like, this is really good. How about, you know, have a listen to these lyrics? And I sort of just made up a melody as they were playing the guitar piece, and it worked.
Was that the verse melody or the chorus melody? What was
it? It was the chorus melody.
Wow. Yeah,
it was the chorus melody.
So you
those
had
are
like,
the lyrics that I first showed them. I said, wake me up when it's all over, when I'm wiser and I'm older. And I have these other lyrics, but they don't necessarily, they're not part of the same song. They're just couplets. I have a bunch of couplets. I said, all this time I've been finding myself, didn't know I was lost. And they're like, sounds perfect. Go in the booth. And so I went in the booth and recorded it. And that's history. It was an acoustic version. And then a couple of days later, Tim sent us his masterpiece.
So you had those lyrics, a couple of the lyrics, and then you heard them playing like that guitar riff,
mm-hmm.
and you did the top line sitting there. You were like, na, 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 and then you went.
And then, so they were happy with that. And Mike was like, okay, I'm going to record the rest of the guitar into the computer.
Yep.
And at that point, like, it's a mad dash to finish two verses.
Yeah.
And so I'm like grabbing couplets from other parts of my, you know, notebook, and then writing new things and finishing the song in the studio. While they're tracking guitar.
Yeah. You're like, give my way to the...
I don't recall if Feeling My Way Through the Darkness was a couplet I already had, or if I had written it just there.
Yeah.
But whatever happened, it all came together nicely.
Did you know when you guys cut it?
I felt good about it. So I listened extensively to a lot of folk songs, singer-songwriters, and I was in the world of my very favorites. Joni Mitchell, James Taylor, Paul Simon, Bill Withers, Nina Simone, Stevie Wonder. I was already in that zone.
Yeah.
Just because I listened to that stuff incessantly.
Yeah.
But I didn't know what was going to happen after that night with just an acoustic song.
Right.
Right?
It was really just like acoustic guitar and vocals. Yeah. That's what you guys cut.
Yeah. But after I heard Tim's production, I was like, this is huge. This is pretty big. Still don't know what's going to happen. It's not my world. My world is not EDM.
Yeah.
And you know, the most success I'd had up to then was I Need a Dollar, which was kind of niche success, even though it was pop radio in Europe, but still niche.
Yeah, which of course then got bigger when Wake Me Up blew up. Then your previous song gets bigger. But so to think about Tim, Avicii, I think most people would just think of him as like, you know, electronic producer or whatever. So they wouldn't think about him doing a acoustic guitar and vocal as like the track, starting there as a songwriter. So what was he like as a songwriter in that element before he goes and starts doing his massive electronic production?
Yeah, he was very particular about melody.
Mm.
And so when he either lands on a great melody or someone in the sphere within the cooking of the music comes up on a great melody, he's going to grab it.
Yeah.
You could see really that he was a musician first. The production was all part of his musicianship.
Yeah.
The sonic story that he would tell and the sounds that he would choose, the placements, the dynamics, all of that was part of his musicianship. That's what he brought to the table.
So you guys cut it. You're like, that's a good song. You go home. He, what, a day, a week later, sends you a track?
It was very quick. I couldn't say it was more than 2 weeks. Okay. I'd like to say it was 2 days, really.
Yeah, yeah.
I think it was really quick.
Quickly sends you a track.
Yeah.
So now you're hearing your voice with the production.
Yeah, and so at that point, it was sped up with some auto, with some tuning on my vocal.
Yeah.
And I was like, I don't know. I'm a sucker for an acoustic track, you know, like a Grandma's Hands or, Big Yellow Taxi.
Absolutely.
Right. But he knows what he wants to deliver.
Yeah.
And at that point I become an instrument for his, vision.
Yeah.
And, you know, to his credit, he was right.
Wow.
Totally right.
So that's when you first heard the dun, dun, da, 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 dun, da, 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 dun.
That is
dun.
The first time I heard it, which was not present when I was in the studio. They ended up doing that part after. And here's the interesting thing. I need to ask Mike about this.
Yeah.
But his wife is a bluegrass musician.
Mm.
She plays
banjo.
Banjo. Yeah. I think she also plays violin probably or fiddle. And my thought is she was heavily an influence on that track.
I mean, that's a banjo melody.
I mean,
it sounds just,
I think that, you know, in the same way that I was influenced by my hero songwriters, I think that, you know, Mike might've been influenced by his hero wife.
That's so beautiful. Wow. So then you hear that version of the track. You have your little things. You're like, well, I wish it was different, but that's okay.
No.
It's okay.
No, I hadn't heard my voice that different before in terms of the auto tune and having been sped up.
Right.
But it's the genre.
Yeah.
So
then that song comes out and becomes a massive smash.
Yeah.
What happens to your life?
Lots and lots of inbound phone calls, emails, requests.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's time to kind of see what's possible. And so lucky enough, we had a lot of interest from European festivals. So I was like, okay, let's go to Europe and spend the summer. We'll get an Airbnb in Berlin, hang out with our friends in Berlin, and I'll just go on day trips to festivals. That was awesome.
That's the best.
Come back home and then get tapped to do this Bruno Mars tour. And I'm like, this is perfect. This is amazing. Let's do it. And then I, you know, go on tour and I felt like, you know, this is the level that I want to tour at.
Yeah.
My goal is to make the very best songs that I can make and also make them the very best, hits that I can make as well. Because that's a beautiful experience to tour on that level. It's not,
my God,
you're not, you know, in motels anymore.
No, we're in Four Seasons. We're in the Four Seasons.
Yeah.
There's catering. That's really nice.
Yeah.
Traveling catering, not local catering.
Mm-hmm.
Traveling catering.
Yeah.
And what a blessing that I can only imagine being in music, being an artist, you're never sure how much income you're going to make at any time. You know, you have a hit, you don't, you're struggling, you're not. Your wife gets pregnant. You have a kid right as your biggest hit comes out.
Yeah.
That's got to feel really good to know you have that safety blanket of cash that's going to come in.
We're good. Yeah.
You're good. And then even with that, you still made the decision. You're like, I'm going to prioritize my family and not tore my ass off.
Yeah.
Cool. This is going to make streaming money and whatever else.
And it did.
Yeah.
And it still does.
Yeah.
And I feel blessed to have, like I said, the best of both worlds now.
Yeah. So I also heard you say that you got to a point where you felt like you had enough money for you and your family and like your grandkids.
Yeah.
And so now you're just doing you.
Yeah.
Right. And going after your life mission and where you don't have to as much think about cash. Of course, you have to in order to fund projects like a biotech company. It's going to take some dollars.
Lots.
I read a really interesting study that one of my mentors gave me that said the ideal number for happiness, for the happiness meter. Because a lot of people think, I want to be a billionaire or whatever. And I actually have known and do know a couple billionaires, and they're not necessarily just the happiest people, right? So the study that I read said that the ultimate happiness number for you, for someone to have, is $17 million. If you go over $17 million, it actually becomes more stressful. Mm-hmm. It actually becomes work, right?
Wow.
So like, so someone that has $17 million, which of course is still a shitload of money.
It's crazy.
Right?
That's a crazy amount. Yeah. Like, it's ridiculous.
But I think we're in a delusional world where, especially now that you're, you know, being in biotech or being in Silicon Valley, being in like in the startup world where it's like, you need to build a $1 billion company or it's a failure.
Right.
Right. Like it's so fucked up where people think like now there's Taylor Swift being a billionaire, Jay-Z's billionaire, all these, you know, you're like, oh, billionaire.
That's the new measure.
Billionaire. Yeah. Like, oh, I'm balling. It's like, okay. But to think that the actual happiness number of ultimate is 17 million, because with 17 million, you can do whatever you want. Your family's good. Your grandkids are good. Your great grands are good. As long as you're not an idiot with that $17 million, dollars, right? I thought that was kind of freeing in being an entrepreneur, right? And always having high bars, and I'm trying to push myself. I'm trying to achieve as much as possible, you know? And you think like, oh yeah, I want $100 million or whatever it is. But it's actually the thought of like actually getting $100 million could be,
a headache
and make you less happy of a human compared to if you had 17 million.
Right.
You know, like I'm curious on your thought of being like, okay, I have enough money now.
Okay.
Right.
I'm going to tell you, you know, there's a guy named Jay Brown. He runs
Rock Nation.
Very, very smart guy. Very good guy.
Yeah.
I've been lucky enough to meet really good people in this business.
Jay's awesome.
And he said to me, as things were taking off, he was like, you know, as you make money, just, and every time you have a kid, he said, this is what he does. He buy a house for your kid, you know, put it in a trust, buy a house for the kid. Just smart ways to use the money to establish legacy so that should anything catastrophic happen, that there's always that safety net.
Yeah.
And so I always kept that in mind and had, you know, good advisors.
Yes.
And I'm, you know, very, very, I live simply. I don't live beyond my means. So my number isn't the 17 million. It's more like, what is the smart way to establish legacy so that no one can ever mess it up?
Yes.
And so you create your trust, you create your executors, you make sure that your kids can't touch a certain amount of it, and you, so that they're good, but you also want to instill autonomy and, you know, give them a sense of executive power that they know how to run their lives. They're not just waiting for this cash to jump in.
Yes.
And, you know, that's also part of it, like teaching them how to make a living rather than just losing it. There's like this four generation cycle of making money and losing money.
Yes.
And I'm not trying to be part of that cycle.
Yeah. And like what value actually is.
Yeah. Understanding value.
Yeah. It's awesome. I love it. And I love, so I love, cause same with me in terms of how you're now on this CEO journey, which is completely different. Of course, there's a lot of crossover because as Aloe Black, the artist, you're the CEO of your company being the music, and you got your band and you got your manager and you got your label and blah, blah, all that kind of stuff. But it's completely different when it's a tech company.
Yeah. Very different.
And there's a lot of learning curves.
There's so much more at stake. The worst that can happen in music is that I hit a wrong note.
Yeah.
Like in biotech, if you hit a wrong note, people die. Yeah. So.
You can't do that. And I'm sure that what you're learning is even just being a leader as you lead this biotech team and everything is probably going to go back into you as a dad, back into you as a husband, back into you as an artist when it is time for you to be like touring again, or if you do tour again, or if you're just doing these one-offs and leading your band. You know, are there any key lessons that you've already been learning as an entrepreneur that you see bleeding into other areas of your life?
The sooner you can be honest, the better.
Yeah.
Try to be honest with humility, so you don't have to destroy people's feelings. Just be honest with humility.
That's a good one.
The path is like the idea of success.
Yeah.
In the Western modern world, especially in America, we use the term success as a synonym for uber wealth or money, right? And I think it's really important to learn how to define the word success for yourself.
Yeah.
Rather than just espousing the contemporary, semantics, I try to use the word success just to mean happiness, but yeah. also achieving a goal. Also, failure, right? What is failure? Failure is synonymous with loser, right? And my thought is, you only lose when you don't try.
Yeah.
If you try and you fail, do not equate failing with losing. If you try and you fail, equate that with learning. Mm-hmm. So failure is learning.
Yes.
Learning is success, right? So just changing the meaning of words is really important.
Yes.
And owning it for yourself.
Yes.
I like to think of failure as successing. I am successively learning how to succeed, right? And so just you can eliminate the word failure.
Yes.
I just successed and I'm still successing.
I love that. Trying is success and learning is success.
Yeah.
As long as you're just doing, you are good.
Yeah. You know, 90% of biotechs fail for multiple reasons. They call it the valley of death. It's either you lose funding, you lose support, you lose interest, or the science fails.
Yeah.
Regulatory doesn't appreciate it. And it's all an important part of the journey of finding the solutions to saving lives.
Yeah.
You know, and if you don't make it this far, at least if the science fails, that's not a failure.
Yeah.
That is an important boundary that lets other scientists know we don't have to waste any time or money on that.
Yes.
Let's go here
yes.
and get to the solution faster.
Yes.
And so I just wrote a song with a guy named Don Miggs. We were thinking about this concept called crash. I'm not afraid to crash into these walls, right? Why? Because the walls are not stopping me. They are directing me.
Mm.
If I run into a wall, the wall says, okay, you can't go this way. Turn around, try a different direction. And that's just as important, I think, as anything, just knowing what direction to go in.
Absolutely. You are spending a lot of time with philanthropy as well. You said you were like, how do I make the biggest impact possible? You and your wife are like focused on that. When did you become this version of you? Were you always this amazing guy? Did you have to work on yourself? Is this the influence of your wife? Is it her? Like, where does this come from?
So shout out to Maya Jupiter. I would say influence of Maya Jupiter. Like trying to continuously be the best version of myself that I can be.
Yeah.
When she moved to the States from Australia, she was working on an album and her producer was... one of our very, very closest family friends, Quetzal Flores, and his wife, Martha Gonzalez. They are amazing human beings, deep in the work of activism and deep in the work of cultural sustainability. And their influence, I think, helped me in a major way, keep me grounded. So Maya bringing the right people into my life to make me realize what really is important. If it wasn't for her, I totally would have been trying to compete with the Chris Browns and the Ushers of the world.
Yeah.
And that's a whole different trajectory and a completely different lifestyle.
Yeah, for sure. You can keep your shirt on. Wear a jacket.
That's the thing. I was like, John Mayer wears jeans and a t-shirt. Can I just wear jeans? I don't want to dance. Adele doesn't dance on stage. She just stands in one place and sings. Like, can I do that?
You can do that because your voice is incredible, man.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
I love your voice. I know everyone probably always gushes over your voice to you, but like what I thought was really amazing too, because you have this like strong, you know, you have like a baritone voice. It's power. There's like this full voice that comes out of you. And then when I saw you on The Masked Singer, and then you came out and played that Maxwell song, and you have this like high falsetto I didn't know you did like that. And you did the whole song. And I was like, man, Aloe Black has range.
So I was saying, if it wasn't for Maya, I would have been all over the place. When I was on Stone's Throw, I was experimenting with every sound and style.
Wow.
I was trying to approximate everything that I could from any genre you could imagine. And that's where I started developing this range. I actually, you know, in 2004 or something like that, I recorded, translated the lyrics to This Woman's Work into Spanish and recorded a Spanish version of it. At the same time, translated John Legend's Ordinary People into Spanish, recorded a Spanish version of it. And I think that was one of the first things that my wife heard of me in Australia. She'd heard some of my early hip hop stuff, but when she heard the Spanish, she was like, oh, because she's half Mexican. So yeah. There's this, and my parents are from Panama. There's this Latin relationship that we have in our history, in our family, that helps with our bond as well.
You've really impacted my life when you reached out to me with Prop 28, Proposition 28 passed to bring funding back to arts and music education, $1 billion a year. I wasn't hip to it. And you called me or you hit me up and said, yo, let's have a meeting. And you told me about Prop 28 and how it passed. And it's this whole thing. And you think that, you know, you'd like to introduce me to Austin Buettner, who is the author of Proposition 28. And then we met and I joined the Prop 28 committee with you. Mm-hmm. And now we have this whole school gig platform that, you know, very much is a living thing. You know, we have 10 full-time people working on it. We have 3,000 artists on it now that are
so good.
Arts educators or already or interested in becoming arts educators. We have 45 districts on it now representing 750,000 kids. And we're not even in the beginning of hiring season yet. The hiring season is about to start for the school. So man, you like, you hit me up. And then once again, we executed. So thank you. Yeah. But, and we're still constantly executing because that doesn't ever end. But so first of all, thank you.
Thank you for thinking of me. Yeah.
You know, my plate was full before you hit me up, right?
Yeah.
So I want to talk about all of that. But first of all, question, because I don't know this. What made you hit me up for that when you were on the Prop 28 committee? What made you think of me and Jamcard?
So I was on the Prop 28 committee thinking about how can we get to as many artists in one fell swoop as possible.
Yes.
My friend Joel Van Dyke, guitarist, great producer and musician who I worked with for many years, had told me about Jamcard.
Yeah.
And I hit him up and I asked him, explain to me Jamcard. Like, who's on it? What's on it? What's it about?
Yeah.
And he told me, and I thought, this sounds like the kind of technology that could be helpful for what we need to do. Because as we were having our Prop 28 meetings, we're thinking about how to reach out to as many artists as possible.
Yes.
So that they could engage with this new arts education and get paid. I've always been thinking about how can I develop a system by which the musicians that I love and are working with as often as I can continue to have a steady paycheck when I decide that I don't want to be on the road.
Yeah.
How can I make sure that they're still getting paid?
Yes.
One of the thoughts I was thinking was like, how can I turn music into a health modality so that we're using music therapy and I have my musician friends as the practitioners of music therapy for people who can be, improve their mental health outcomes by just sitting while my friends are rehearsing.
Yes.
You know?
Yes.
When Prop 28 came out, I was like, bingo.
Yes.
Here's the money.
Yes.
Here's the opportunity. Here's the place that all of my musician friends, whenever they're off the road looking for a gig, can find a gig.
Yes.
How do we operationalize it? How do we grow it and maximize this opportunity? Jamcard came to mind. And so Joel put me in touch with you.
That's awesome.
And I thought, you have the technology to do this. And you have access to all the musicians.
Yeah.
Maybe you can consult on how we can build something.
Yes.
And instead,
you built it. I went way in. Mm-hmm. I always go too far. I always
That's all right.
Thanks to Joel. Joel, big shout out. That's awesome, man. That's awesome. So we've talked about this on previous podcasts before, and we actually had Austin on the pod, which was great. But if you missed it, Proposition 28 passed in the state of California. It's $1 billion a year for the next 98 years to hire as many artists as possible to be arts educators in California public schools. All California public schools from preschool all the way through high school for the entire state, charter schools, all that included. So it's the big challenge is like, how do we make more awesome teachers? Right. So,
absolutely.
So, and it's for all arts. So it's not just music. Music has been predominant, of course, but there's, you know, visual arts and, acting, what painting, also any kind of art, choreography, dance is all included in there. So we did that. And so now we built this platform, School Gig, which is schoolgig.us, if you want to check it out, if you're interested at all. Where if you're an artist or an arts educator.
No,
or,
you are interested and you will check it out.
You are interested.
You are interested. You know a musician.
Yes.
Or you know a dancer, or you know a visual artist, and they can benefit and the kids can benefit.
Yes.
Do it for the kids. Do it for the kids.
Do it for the kids. This is going to impact millions and millions of kids. And for so long, arts education has been completely, the budget's been cut. So mm-hmm. now the money is there. It's from the state. It comes from non-taxpayer dollars too. So the money is there to hire. If you already are an arts educator, we have jobs for you. If you're interested in becoming an arts educator, as long as you can pass a background check and you're an amazing professional, you love working with kids, you love teaching, yo, we have jobs for you. Like, you can come. There's part-time jobs. There's full-time jobs. It's in your area. So check out schoolgig.us. You create a profile for free. Everything is for free for you. And you can just see what's up. But it's all sorts of positions. So
I like that it's schoolgig.us because it is, we're going to hopefully expand outside of California.
Yes.
You know, if we can get legislation like this in other states,
yes,
would be huge.
Yeah. I just met with the mayor of Atlanta and she was like, how do we get this mm-hmm. How do we bring this to Georgia? Whatever.
Okay.
It's like, you got to write a bill.
Yes.
So hopefully, and also the name School Gig.
Named
by Aloe Black.
There were a few options, but School Gig made the most sense.
Yeah, it was. And you know what? I'm so particular too about everything mm-hmm. just in general. But the second someone says a good idea and it resonates, I will make a move immediately. Mm-hmm. So we're like, what's the name? But you were like, it should be School Gig. I was like, it absolutely should be. Thank you, Aloe. That is it.
Great.
Can we get the domain? Great. So thank you. And yeah, it's been awesome.
Yeah.
So what made you get... you just said what made you get into it, but I guess when you were younger, you're a trumpet player, right? First and foremost, did you have a music teacher or someone that like really encouraged you to do music?
I really had great music teachers, but the encouragement to do music, you know, I think it was just wanting to do something different than being in class for the general music class. You know, we'd have a music teacher that would come into the classroom and like give people a tambourine or a shaker or something, and then we'd sing songs. And there was an opportunity to go to the multipurpose room and learn an instrument.
Yeah.
And I thought, that sounds like much more fun. But then when I saw all the instruments, I just picked the one with the fewest keys on it because I figured it'd be easier to play.
Not the easiest instrument.
Yeah, not the easiest instrument, but I learned the trumpet third grade, played it all the way up until like freshman year in high school. That's when I transformed my interest from that to hip hop and just started recording hip hop music.
That's amazing. What do you think is the importance of arts education for kids?
Oh, huge. So reading a lot of papers, as I do, because I want the facts. The kind of brain growth that happens when learning an instrument is like learning a new language. The pathways, neural pathways that are created to make those connections are like highways that can be used to connect things that you don't even know you're going to be able to connect in the future. So you might as well build those pathways as soon as possible, as early as possible. That's the nerd part of me. The other thing is music and art is cultural experience. This is how we fellowship as humans, yes, with art and music. And so it's part of our communicative dance. And I think we all should be engaging. I don't think we should be spectators when it comes to art. I think everybody should be involved.
Beautiful.
And, you know, I feel like it makes us more creative. So I think it works both parts of your brain, both left and right. You know, you're creative and you're analytical. But in making us more creative, it helps us to solve problems that may arise easier. And I think it unifies us. I think, yeah, if there were more musicians and artists, do you think we would have wars? Do you know what I mean? Like,
absolutely.
If we were just a bit more, you know, engaged in this communal effort of harmony.
Yeah.
And choreographing this amazing universal dance.
Yeah.
And just blending different colors. I think the world would be a much more peaceful place.
Absolutely. I'm a drummer. So drums for me when I was a kid, first of all, if you're the drummer, you're the backbone of your band. So you have to have the confidence to be like, I'm holding this together, yeah, which then led to me, taught me how to be a leader, right? And taught me confidence and all this. And then of course, playing in front of people. Now I speak in front of people, mm-hmm, like all that kind of stuff. And communicating, I shouldn't play too loud because then you can't hear that guy,
mm-hmm,
right? And then improvisation that comes with that, which is just a musical conversation, learning, oh, this is speaking. It's a whole other language.
Yeah.
And all that changed my life. And then on top of that, if I'm ever angry, if I have aggression as a kid, talk about less wars, I'd go take it out on my drums.
Yeah.
And then I'm happy.
Yeah.
You know, like drums changed my life. Like it's the most positive thing that ever happened to me. Like, and everyone always says still to this day, whenever they see me play drums, they're like, you have the biggest smile on your face when you're drumming. I'm like, yeah, it's my favorite thing to do.
Absolutely.
I'd rather, I mean, if you had your trumpet, I'm a drums around, I'd rather do that, honestly, this conversation. No, I'm kidding. Yeah, dude. But well, thank you for putting so much time of yours and effort and attention and thought into the music education, arts education system. Because you've been giving a lot.
Yeah, I mean, it's what we're all here for.
Yeah.
I just encourage all of my peers and fans to get involved as well.
Final question.
Mm.
So on the whiteboard, we always have this Easter egg where people sign their names or they draw a photo or draw a picture, ask you to draw something. I have no idea what that is. What is that?
This is a representation that I came up with when I was an MC and writing lyrics.
Yeah.
And I wrote these lyrics that said, grab a pencil and paper, draw four lines square like a box, and to the left of that box, put a dot. That's the spot where I be thinking a lot. Unconventional thought, the kind of reasoning philosophers got, speaking in scientist talk. So the idea is think outside the box.
I love Black, ladies and gentlemen. Go back and listen to the old records. I'm going to go listen to rapper Allo Black. Dude, thank you so much, man. I value our friendship and I'm glad we're working together on this. And any way we can help any of your projects, I'm excited for you to just continue being an artist as well. And I'm excited to continue to learn from your balance as I try to balance. And if you or your wife have any potential wives for me, just let me know.
Okay.
I want to be a dad soon. My mom needs it.
Okay.
My mom's
for your,
like,
mom. We do it for your mom.
We do it for mom. Go Everything's for mom.
Go with Elmo.
Yes, much love,
go
bro. Thank you.
All right.
Go with Elmo. 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 This is the stuff, man.